Welcome to Soul Sessions with Creative Mind with Deborah Burnt Maldonado and Dr. Rob Maldonado of Creative Mind. Join us each week for an inspiring conversation about personal development based on Jungian philosophy, Eastern spirituality, and social neuroscience. Spend each week with us to explore deep topics in a practical way. Let's begin.
Welcome back.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Soul Sessions.
Yeah, another exciting edition of Soul Sessions. And today we're talking about shamanism, the spiritual influences of shamanic traditions in coaching. And maybe you could help me with this. We should clarify what our perspective or what perspective we're taking in talking about shamanism. Okay. Yeah, so definitely a Jungian perspective. Mm-hmm. And Jung would say...
He kind of was called the shaman, like in his day, right?
Yeah, but he didn't like that.
Oh.
he
thought of it as like a more mystical, like it was too mystical for science, or...
Well, his whole idea was... Just because we study these things and we talk about them doesn't mean that we're embracing them or condoning them as a way of doing psychology or doing coaching.
That's actually interesting because it's true. A lot Jung looked at a lot of different things. Yeah. He looked at astrology. He looked at psychic ability. He looked at all these things, and everyone thinks, well, he was into that, and he was into shamanism. Even in Eastern philosophy, he also said that with all these different approaches to spirituality, that in the Western world, what he saw was happening even back then in the early 1900s was that yoga tradition moving over and these like East, you know, or foreign influences that are not like Western come in, infiltrating the culture. And then people wanted, especially in the 60s, and, you know, people were wanting to go on these trips.
Hey, we're in California.
Yeah, that's true. And he said that he had a warning for people to don't let go, don't repress your Western roots, because it really on a deep level, even genetically, we are predisposed to see the world through the genetics of our ancestors. And of course, there's these, we go back all to the same source, but you know, on a personal level at first, it's kind of a stretch for us to try to fit in a Western mind to see the Eastern philosophy or other philosophies. So he was very, you know, always kept bringing up that idea that if you're in the West, try to find a way to merge versus abandon your Western ideas too.
Yeah.
Because you're not going, it's not going to be as effective because somewhere deeply within you, even on a personal level, you're conditioned to think a certain way, like a Westerner. So for example, giving up your possessions for enlightenment, a lot of people, misinterpret that and they think, oh, the West is bad. They're materialistic. But the real truth is it's the merging of both. And how do we do that? So let's talk about what is shamanism?
Well, wait, I have one more point about the point of view, because I think it's important just so that we're not misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. The other element is that we're students of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we're simply acknowledging these different cultural traditions that have existed in all over the world for millennia as interesting aspects of our heritage as human beings. And those two combined, right, that these are, as Jung would say, these are psychological inheritances that they're still playing out in us, whether we acknowledge them or not, whether we like it or not. These influences arise in the mind and in cultures spontaneously, because it's not that we have ideas like we just consciously think of things and express them. It's that ideas possess us, right? They arise in the culture and in the environment, in the mind, in the psyche, and take over in a sense. They become very present, and they become the way we experience the world, and then our job is to kind of ask, well, what's going on here, mm-hmm. you know, who is really driving, what is happening with these ideas. So shamanism, definitely one of those ideas that have it's an archetypal idea in that you can't stamp it out. You mm-hmm. can't repress it. You can't ignore it. You can try, as maybe the scientific perspective has tried to do, but it'll come up somehow or another in another form.
So how would you define shamanism?
Yeah, so then we get to shamanism.
For those who don't know what it is or kind of heard the term many times but aren't clear.
Yeah, I was thinking we could go down the list of the seven universal principles that define shamanism. Mm-hmm. And in going down the list, we can arrive at a definition of it.
Okay. And where's the origin of shamanism? Is it a certain country, certain culture?
I don't think anybody knows.
It's more of an archetype.
Exactly.
Because in different tribes, there were Native Americans in the U.S. and then the tribes in, you know, all over the world have had this, in the indigenous tribes have had this idea of a shaman or a medicine leader or something, the healer of the group.
One of the oldest cave paintings found in France or Spain, I can't remember which one, but one of the oldest ones is this image of a shaman dancing. And we know he's a shaman because he's wearing antlers. Mm. And he appears to be dancing or moving like the animal. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the characteristics of the shaman, that connection with nature and animal life. And so it goes back to our ancient prehistory. So yeah, I think in going down to some of these universal principles, we start to kind of see what the archetype is talking about.
Okay. Let's go. Number one.
So number one, shamans experience a calling.
So it's kind of like a coach even, you know, a coach or a therapist or healer. You have this calling to help others. And it's kind of every story, like origin story of these great, even people that are modern gurus, they always have this story where they have a calling. You know, they have a wake-up call. Is that what you're saying? They kind of feel it's not. It finds the calling finds them. They don't just decide, oh, I want to be a coach. Like people that don't come to us to be a coach because they decide, oh, that looks like a good. You know, I should do that. That's just an option for a career. It's like they have a calling. It's that kind of inner awakening of something deep within them.
Right. That idea of it chooses you, mm-hmm. you don't really choose it. That's
and what, you resist it.
Yes, that's what it's talking about. That you don't really have a choice. It's kind of picked you to do this separate journey from the ordinary life. And you either submit or resist. You know, you either say, okay, I'm going to go along with this, or you resist and... you know, in Campbell's hero's journey, there's that part of resisting the call. Mm-hmm. Where
you answer the call, you resist it.
Yeah.
You get the call, are you going to pick it up? And so this experience of a calling, you know, a lot of people sometimes they try to force themselves into a career that they're not really, that isn't their calling. And so I know a lot of people that they do what their parents told them to do. Be a doctor, be a lawyer, be a be, you know, accountant, and do what I did and or get a job at the factory or do, you know, the things that I did, and this is what works. And then there's this other calling within you. So shamanism is a calling that you can't just decide, ooh, that person, like I want to be like Deepak Chopra, or yeah, I want to be a shaman. And you just decide it's something that comes from within you.
Well, if you look
it
at...
It picks you.
Yeah, some anthropologists, of course, study different cultures and have documented a lot of this stuff. What they find is often there's an illness. There's a type of madness that befalls the person.
Why are you looking at me?
And they go through that dark night of the soul. Mm-hmm. Sometimes very early, as children, they start to hear voices. They experience something out of the ordinary, that signals them out as, oh, this person is not meant to be just part of the everyday tribe, but is going to be trained by the shamans in the tribe.
Even in Buddhism, the lamas, the boy is, the one kid out of the family is chosen to leave the family unit and go study with the monks. So that kind of leaving the ordinary world.
Yeah.
And so, and I think I want to talk about that just a little bit more, because it is the calling. That's why we resist the call, because we have to leave that ordinary world. We have to leave our friends and our the way things were in the comfort zone that we have. And we have to put, and even in the modern world, we have to put ourselves out there. We have to market ourselves, and we have to risk rejection, risk, you know, abandonment from people, or being more exposed in the world. And the shaman, you know, the village will look toward the shaman. It was a big responsibility. When is it the rain going to come? When is a good time to plant the crops? Someone's sick, you got to save them. And it was like kind of like that responsibility that you have to take on. Mm-hmm. You can't just blend with the crowd and be like, it's not my problem.
Yeah, so. you don't have the luxury then of just going along with what everybody else is doing, because you're in this special training, in this special position. Mm. So let's move on to number two, and we can always come back to some of these previous ones. So shamans must undergo a trial.
So we all have, and it is that, like for me, I always felt like my search for love was always this kind of struggle that I had to deal with. And that's what led me to my spiritual work. If I didn't have that, I would have probably just been married with three kids or grandkids now, and hopefully, maybe not, in New Jersey, you know, just living that normal life and ordinary life. But it was through that struggle that gave me so much. It gave me, it kind of broke apart, like almost like separated me already from the normal, like herd of what everyone else was doing. Because I was like not doing, getting married when everyone else was getting married, or going to college when everyone else was going to college. I was kind of like, you know, kind of making my own way already. And then you have that kind of awakening of you want to fit in, but then you don't. And then in that struggle of not fitting in, you find your purpose.
Yeah, and I think this is where kind of people see Jung's life and kind of point out that he went through this period of madness himself where it was a trial, right? It was an existential crisis in a sense. Soon after he split with Freud, he went through, I think it was 2 or 3 years of just kind of looking inward and thinking about what is that fantasy life talking about, and what are these symbols arising from the unconscious?
It's kind of like a state of confusion a little bit. Like we call it madness, but we can experience it in our everyday life, not as like a psychotic break, but more like a little bit of confusion where we just, where are we? What are we doing with my life? What's up? What's down?
Yeah. Well, and if you think about shadow work, it is very difficult in that respect of you have to think about, facing your fears, not just the external fears that we all have, but those deep existential fears that you have to really come to terms with them. And that is a kind of a trial by fire because it's going to test you. It's going to see what you're really made out of.
Are you looking for a satisfying career that has meaning and purpose? Are you seeking a path of growth and wish you could have it all in one program? Well, Creative Mind University has a Jungian Life Coach training program that does just that. You can start a new career as a certified life coach, trained in a unique methodology based on Jungian philosophy, Eastern spirituality, and social neuroscience. Get the tools to become your true self and make an amazing transformation in your life and the lives of others. Visit creativeminduniversity.com. Click on apply and speak with one of our team members today to discuss your future and possibilities of becoming a certified life coach. That's creativeminduniversity.com. I always say that you have to, if you can face the shadow work, you can accomplish anything. It's really that, like Ryung says, it's a tight passage that feels very constricting and you don't want to go down. But on the other side is this vast openness and freedom that you never felt before. But you have to kind of go through that trial to get to that place.
Yes. And you see this in many cultural shamanic traditions where the person has to undergo this ordeal. Mm. They have to survive in the wilderness by themselves. They have to swim an impossible length of ocean. They have to find something that's very difficult to find.
The treasure hard to find.
Yes. And that marks them as fit for the larger process of being a shaman.
And we see this in movies and in stories and myths about the trials. One was the trial of Psyche when she had to win Eros's heart back. Mm. She had to, the mother made her do all these things like taking seeds and counting them and doing all this so to earn her right way.
Absolutely. So number three, this is like David Letterman, the top ten.
No.
So number three for the shamans, their craft requires them to shift their perception.
Mm.
This is again a universal. There is no shamanic tradition that does not involve this shifting of perception from the ordinary perception of the persona, the ego, to this higher perception of the true nature of things. Mm. What do things really mean? Why do they exist? How do they exist? How do things come about?
Mm.
The shaman is either instructed or intuitively finds this element in their inner journey.
So they basically see things differently than the ordinary person.
Yes.
So in that their own shift of perception, they can actually do the work of a shaman, which is to help others, because they have to have the shift. They can't be with them trying to save a drowning person. They have to be kind of like throw in the knowing what they need to do to pull them out. So that kind of one of the common ways they heal is they don't see the person as broken. Mm. They see the person as already healed. So that's their perception, is they're not seeing what the evidence is of the senses. And so that's how they are able to heal the person, not seeing they're broken and they have to fix it. They're already seeing their potential. And that's really where we agree with that kind of philosophy, because that's really where people grow and have the best success, is when the coach or the therapist or the shaman is holding that vision for the person and not seeing them as not becoming, you know, as having struggles, and seeing them as becoming their full potential.
Yeah, I think Jung would say that shift is happening, or what is happening psychologically is that the person is shifting from identifying with the ego, the ordinary sense of the conceptual mind,
mm-hmm.
To a deeper sense of the psyche, the totality of the psyche, which he called the self.
Mm.
And that shift does give the shaman a different perception in the world, basically.
They can see possibilities that other people can't see.
Yeah.
And intuitively connect to like creativity that the ordinary person can't.
Yeah. And of course, that does require the sacrifice of that ordinary life.
Mm.
Because once you shift perception, you can no longer be that persona that the ordinary person gets to kind of be in that oblivion, right? Mm. That kind of the idea of ignorance is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where it comes from, that if you stay in the ordinary world, yeah, you get to just kind of live your life, your individual life in your little bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you shift that perception, you no longer have that luxury.
I know, it's kind of weird, because it's so freeing to be able to create your life. But then sometimes I see people that are just you know, in my life, I see some people just living their lives and they're, you know, having their weekends and they kind of ordinary life, and it's fulfilling for them. And it's almost like, wow, you know, I wish that it's like ignorance a little bit, that you kind of feel like that's enough. And then it's like, wow, it would be so less pressure to be there. But then again, that's where all the suffering is. So there's this kind of like giving up the ordinary for the extraordinary. And there's always a sacrifice that you have to make. And a lot of times the shaman, in certain cultures, they don't take on partners. They marry the divine. They don't have kids. They do different things with their life. They give up that ordinary, the ordinary things that people want or feel important. They stretch themselves to,
yeah,
almost kind of for a bigger purpose than just their own ego's fulfillment.
Yeah, that's another interesting question, is how does that relate to organized religion? Because you do see it in the Catholic Church, right, that if you're going to be a priest or a nun, you take certain vows that separate you from the ordinary life and take you into a kind of another priestly level. I think Jung would say, yeah, there is a connection, but organized religion is a little bit more formalized than they kind of...
Well, Buddhists, too, they don't marry the nuns.
Yeah, that's
they
true.
They take abstinence.
Yeah, I'm just using the Catholic religion as an example, but all organized religions essentially do this. They create a dogma, meaning a set of beliefs and practices, a philosophy that the adherents to that religion follow then and say, yeah, we have to fall in line and do these things this way. Whereas in shamanistic traditions, the shaman is a little bit more free to express that calling in a more creative way. And that's where you see the influence on coaching. And that coaching is, in a sense, free from the constraints of traditional therapeutic
forms.
So
we don't have to be abstinent as a coach?
I don't think so. You don't have to wear your habit.
I don't have to wear a habit.
Yeah.
I can't get married. I can get married.
You can get married. And
I can drink alcohol if I want to.
Yeah. And you see... like some of these coaches that do fire walking, or you mentioned some of the other things that when we were talking about this,
like the drugs. What are they called?
The retreats.
Yeah, where they just kind of psychedelics, hallucinogenics.
And yes, certainly those traditions or those kind of retreats where people are put back in nature and are guided to experience nature in this new way, perhaps through the aid of hallucinogenics, that comes from shamanic traditions. Drumming, playing of music, dancing.
I did drum circles when I was in Colorado. That was so much fun. There's something about just sitting around and the passion and singing and just beautiful. Very ritualist. There's a lot of ritual in shamanism. The ritual, the dancing, the drumming, the experience, the visioning.
Absolutely. Let's see. So where are we?
Number five or four?
Yes, number four. So yes. Yeah, so
we're only on number four.
Yeah, because that shift of perception is a big step. But then there are higher steps. That number four, shamans are required to be knowledgeable about different states of mind or different states of consciousness, like dreaming. Dreaming is probably the most, the one that most people are familiar with. That there is this tradition of lucid dreaming, out-of-body experiences, dream healing, astral travel, where the shaman is able to exit their body, their consciousness is able then to observe the world from that different vantage point.
And so the knowledge of the different levels of awareness and consciousness.
Yes.
Very important.
That's right. And in modern day, of course, that falls in the realm of psychology as well. That's why Jung kind of emphasized those ideas as well. That
because they're working with the mind, and he wanted to understand.
Yes, but I would say, if you read his writings carefully, he wanted to not just go back to the past and say, let's embrace this past of being in touch with nature, but he wanted to say, or he wanted to include what we know now in the West, meaning the scientific information that's coming through, to ask this question, can we be both? Can we bring those traditions that are very much part of our natural history as human beings, but also include what we know from our conscious experimentation with nature?
So what's an example of that?
There is none. I mean, that was his whole question to us, is why do we have to split science and magic? If magic or...
Science is magic.
Well, in a way, it has the possibility.
Yeah.
That's what he was pointing at, that it has the possibility of being a new shamanistic tradition, in a sense, because we are working with alchemy when we work with science. We're working with the elements.
So we're not abandoning science, and then we're not just sticking with science. We're blending and able to look at both sides.
He would definitely say that if you neglect part of your human nature, which is the need for transcendence, the need for magic, the need for
creativity,
symbolic
imagination.
Yes. You're doing yourself a great disservice, and you're playing with fire, because anything you reject and you push into the unconscious, it's going to take its revenge on you eventually. It's going to trip you up.
It's going to come around.
That's right.
So someone who's a very structured personality and scientific would probably create an experience with it, a relation with someone who's chaotic and, you know, out of control, and, you know, that not even romantically, but seem to be attracting those kind of people in their life because it's their shadow. Is that what you're saying?
Not only their shadow, I think there's more to it. I think the shadow is very kind of a personal experience, but in the larger collective consciousness of humanity, we're very split, if you notice. We're very lopsided. We're all about rationality and science and that power that working with the elements gives us, the ability to transform the earth. But we're neglecting the soulful part. You know, a lot of the shamans, one of their main purposes was to deal with this phenomena called soul loss.
Wow, soul loss.
Soul loss, yes. Before. It is the disconnect of your conscious mind with the unconscious roots.
And there's a part of us that's never disconnected from our soul, but we're consciously not connecting to it.
That's right.
We're ignoring it.
Yes.
And that's where the soul says, hello, guess what? Dark night of the soul. It's going to come out and try to, well, I feel like it disrupts your life. Like I told you, my manless, jobless, and homeless time when I was in my mid-30s, is I was just totally on the wrong track, and I was ignoring what my soul was like intuitively saying, you're on the wrong track. And I kept pushing it away because I wanted this like perfect life, normal, ordinary life. And it just pulled it out from under. It was like it created the situation where it was nothing worked, and it made me realize, okay, it's time. And so we just kind of you can't, when you have that calling, you can't ignore it. It will find you. And so I always find that people, no matter how they try to avoid their purpose, it's something is going to keep intervening until it happens, and it'll appear outside as just this bad luck or fate. But it's really the soul saying, I need to stretch. I need to get your attention. I love that.
Yeah, so understanding basically what is the mind, and how does the mind create both wellness and illness, and more than that, right? How does it interact in the cosmos? So that's the shaman's domain. They act as intermediaries between the ordinary life and the bigger cosmology of the universe. So number five is shamans recognize the sacredness of nature.
The symbolic life.
The symbolic life. What Jung would call the symbolic life. So in the symbolic life, the individual that is undergoing this transformation begins to see the external, the appearance of the world, the universe, in that symbolic sense that it's speaking to them.
Mm. Yeah, it's like going in nature and you're kind of looking for signs and yeah. Everything is alive. I remember when we moved from Colorado and we were moving to New York. It was when we first met. And there was this beautiful white owl that would come, like that was around us and outside of our townhome. And I remember we were just packing up everything. You and I were just standing on that porch and the white owl came as if to say goodbye, you know, like see you later, like kind of like that kind of connectedness to nature. And then anytime we would make decisions and stuff, you would always like notice the birds flying, the hawks, and you know, kind of a symbols of that synergy of what's happening in here and what's happening out there.
Well, yeah, I think humans have forgotten what it means to be in nature. Mm. Now, when we think of nature, we might think, well, these beautiful parks or national forest or mountain ranges. But being in nature is a very different experience. Really being part of it and really connecting with the earth and that presence that's there in nature is very different. It is that experience of that you get the sense that you are in a living thing. You're not just visiting. You're not a tourist in a park. You're part of this bigger cosmology, the cosmos, mm-hmm. that is very much alive, mm. very much present, very much conscious. And that experience, you know, it's something so valuable that we've traded it for technology, mm. you know, for these gadgets that somehow are supposed to.
It kind of dims us down, like shuts down all our senses to yeah. connect with it in a way. Our intuition is kind of shut down.
Yeah. And I don't think it's about going back to nature and just rejecting technology, but it's about acknowledging that we can be both and mm-hmm. we can have both. And
so we can take our laptop in nature.
Why not? But also because the technology is part of nature as mm-hmm. well. It's simply our human nature.
You know, it's interesting when you say that too, because I think that, when COVID hit last year, one of the things I thought of, because it made everyone think of what the heck is going on, and I'm thinking, we have all this technology, we're modern people, and this little microscopic piece of nature has shut down the world. And it's just so amazing that we forget that we're part of a system, you know, that we're not invincible, we're not super, you know, our technology wasn't capable even of handling this little bug. And it's just kind of humbling in a way. Mm. And I think it also made us all, I think a lot of people look at health and their bodies. And that's part of the natural world our bodies are a living organism. This nature is also within us, is every cell and what we put in, the food we put in our body. So this kind of whole connection to getting out of just this cognitive, technical mindset and getting into our heart and our soul and our nature. I don't know. It just gave me this like mind-blowing perspective on we're so arrogant human beings that we're so invincible that we don't need nature, and we actually do. We need, because we're living in this precarious world of flowing through space on this tiny rock in the middle of space. And you know, it's like that that kind of remembering that we're part of this bigger picture, this bigger cosmos, and that we're connected to it. We're not separate.
Right. And that Jungian perspective would say that nature is not just necessarily the external. That nature is our own psyche.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? The deeper psyche is nature itself.
It's just a different... It appears what we're seeing out there is really what's really going on inside of us, like a glimpse of what the depth of who we are.
Yeah, yes.
Like Thoreau said, outside, what has been before us are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. Mm-hmm. I'm botching up that quote, but that's a beautiful quote.
Thoreau?
I think it was Thoreau.
So number six, shamans act as intermediaries between the worlds. And there's many different cosmologies, but one of the main ones is that there are these three worlds. So there's the world below, which is the earth, and the caves that take you underground. We see that in some of the older cave paintings. They were deep underground, and people would actually have to go through the very narrow slits to get to those deeper caves. And then they would paint these beautiful images, these symbols, on the walls of the cave. Mm-hmm. And nobody really knows why they would bother to do that, because there's no light down there. They would have to illuminate their activity somehow through fires. Or
maybe they were putting like prayers underneath for the earth above.
That's certainly one of the...
I'm not an anthropologist,
but one of the theories.
Some of the...
Yeah.
Like maybe some kind of like ritual that you're going underneath to build the good luck for the land above.
And speaking of shamanism, this was probably one of the rituals that the shaman had to undergo.
And he had to also decide what symbols to put on and direct them, how to paint them. And
that's right.
What about under the ocean? Is that would be the same thing as the underworld, or is that different?
There are cultures, for example, island cultures, that they were surrounded by the ocean, and so the shaman's role was to be in touch with it, the animals in the ocean, sharks and other creatures. So yeah, absolutely. But so the three worlds were the world underneath, the world of nature, which is this plane, the waking world, and then the world above, right, the spiritual world, the unseen. And the shaman's role was often to act as intermediary between all those three worlds.
All the worlds.
Yeah. To kind of bridge them and to transverse them.
Where the ordinary person would just stay in the kind of the above the ground world.
Yeah.
And then the shaman would go above and below.
That's right. And of course, that is a very useful skill to have. I mean, you see it in some of the Catholic traditions. You grew up Catholic. Well, where some of the...
I didn't go enter any holes on the ground, but...
No, but what does the Catholic fear?
Hell.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is an underworld. And what do they aspire to?
Let's go to heaven.
I mean, we're simplifying. Obviously, there's more to it than that. But, you know, those kind of ideas arise spontaneously in the human psyche, and you have to deal with them somehow, or they become then neuroses, psychoses, these kind of existential crises.
Well, and if we think about below is like kind of like shadow and things we don't want to see and just only push to this aspiration. And a lot of people think they want to keep like going to the light. Let's just be pure and let's push away the bad. But we have to confront it in a way. And a lot of the hero's journey, you have to go underneath in the caves and fight the dragon. But I love, there's a quote by Jung. He says that in order to reach heaven, a tree to reach heaven, the roots have to reach down to hell. And so it's kind of that, as if you're doing this kind of work and truly helping people transform, you have to face your own hell, like kind of the darkest, the parts that the ordinary person wouldn't want to face, and not demons and stuff like that, which could, we don't want to talk about like demons, but really it's more the
our internal demons,
like where we label them as bad and, yeah. and scary, and when we go down there we realize they're not scary at all. It's just the ordinary person doesn't have the courage to face it, and so the shaman actually is, I'm going to go face this,
yeah,
this thing, and I'm going to change it. And
yeah, and then you see the priests talking about kind of what is done above is also
as above, so below.
So as above, so below, which is kind of part of what the shaman traditionally does, mm-hmm. is that they consecrate the actions in this plane with the spiritual element, right, or the things of the underworld as well.
So like in Catholicism, the priest would bless the bread and the wine, and then the person would take it. But the priest was, basically bringing the light of God into the ordinary world. And so the priest, not everyone can do that. You can't, like, you couldn't walk into a church and say, right. hey, I bless this.
That's right.
The shaman has that special authority to do that. Mm-hmm. And it really psychologically it works that way, because we all know, even in therapy, that you need, or coaching, you need an established authority to really effectuate change, and that's why a lot of people that try to help their friends, I know for myself, you try to help your friends with as a coach or as a therapist, it just doesn't work. That's why they have that kind of the saying, like, refer them out, because it's just they don't see you as that authority. They see you as an ordinary person, or how they always seen you, and it's almost like you have to leave the ordinary world to become the guru or the master in another culture or another tribe. They don't expect you,
yeah,
is that what
exactly, because that authority, I mean, remember the Catholic Church up until recently, I think, was doing exorcisms.
Mm-hmm. They're not doing them anymore?
I don't know.
I don't know. I haven't talked to them lately.
Yeah.
I could ask my mom. She'll know.
There you go. But you see there that's a very shamanistic activity.
Like, get rid of the evil spirits.
Yes. But if you talk to priests, I mean, most of those guys are educated, by the Jesuits, who are... they're scientists and philosophers, they're not buying into that kind of superstitious outlook on things. But you see that often shamans would play those roles as a service to the community.
So on that topic, from a psychological perspective, before modern psychology 100 years ago, 150 years ago, people that had weird, like schizophrenia or I don't know if autism was recognized, in probably that kind of work, or mental retardation. There's some kind of, a lot of times there's that, this idea that, they're possessed, or, they're displeased God, or something like that, right, that superstition right. around mental health. And so that would be, the shaman would come in and they would call them in to heal or even an illness too, right? When people were ill, they had a physical illness like cancer or something, they think it's the evil spirits coming in.
Yeah, exactly. Because for example, in schizophrenia, before the modern age of psychopathology, people didn't know what to make of it. There was nothing physically wrong that they could find with the person, mm-hmm. but yet they were possessed by these crazy ideas and behaviors. And so one of the go-to explanations was, they must be possessed by a demon or some kind of spirit. Mm. And so they would take them to the church, right, to get exercise. There's definitely that. There's also the other part that, if shamans, for example, initially undergo this dark night of the soul that appears to be madness, how many people have we locked up in insane asylums when they were simply going through this calling, but they were labeled as a mental disorder?
Or even depression. They have those states of depression where they're kind of lost and they don't know. They kind of have that lack of... of not a will to live, but more like a passion for life. You know, they're not really like, they're just kind of law, and they're just feeling, a shaman can come in and lift that person up.
Yes. So one more.
Okay.
We're down to seven.
Lucky number seven.
The shamans, one of their primary functions is to address this soul loss. So we mentioned that already, but let's expand it a little bit. So if soul loss is this disconnect with our own psyche, collectively, humans have reached this point where there is mass soul loss. Right. We know from the statistics, the statistics don't lie, the numbers don't lie, that there's, you know, depression, anxiety, suicide, all these are way up, way up. There's like a crisis of meaning. People can't find meaning in their life anymore.
Well, they said that people that are, they did the research of people that are working for companies, and most of the employees are 80%, 89% are actively disengaged in what they do. Mm-hmm. So you have this whole mass of workers that are just working for that paycheck and just completely disillusioned. And that's why on Mondays is the highest rate of heart attacks. People are just like, oh, I just want to go back to work. The Sunday night blues. I remember I had the Sunday night blues. Oh, like, got to go to work again. And, or even on vacation, I'd be like counting the day, like, oh no, I only have 3 days left. And you live for those short, like, bursts of vacation. And the rest of your life is filled with this meaningless job. And it's not a way to live. It really isn't. But yes, that's that soul, like, it's kind of, they call it the soul sucking corporate job, right?
Yeah, that, it's in the language, exactly. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that, again, that we pushed away these very human, natural expressions of our connectedness with nature, with the cosmos, with dreams, magic, and simply we bought into this idea that, oh, we can reason everything out, right? In philosophy, I think it's called rational positivism, which states erroneously
states for a reason.
Something like that, but it states that if I have enough information, if I gather enough information about this topic, I will be able to solve it completely. Mm-hmm. And that nothing works that way in the universe. Everything has its mystery. Everything has its always. It keeps its secrets. We exist in harmony with it, or in harmony or in disharmony with it, and I would say we're in disharmony with the natural world right now, right?
Well, look at what's happening to the planet.
Yeah, and we think we can build our way out of it, or like think our way out
Mars.
Of it.
Go to Mars, let's start over.
Yeah, or build more technology against it. That's not going to work. We are nature, and we are part of it.
So we have to change ourselves. They say if you want to change the world, you got to change yourself first. Be the change.
Yes, and the answer again, from the shamanistic, from the Jungian perspective, from the natural kind of bigger picture of what is a human being, what does it mean to be a human being? The answer is within, not finding more, or not building more technology, but of exploring that inner
technology, right?
Yeah, the inner psyche.
Like building like the scaffolding for you to explore the deeper self, deeper parts of yourself. Like, how do we build a way for us, like a carving out a path for us to find ourselves?
Yeah.
Our soul is like pushing up, and we think it's because we're dissatisfied with the material things in life, but the soul is pushing up saying, the materialist things in life are not the answer. But our ego is saying, oh, well, maybe if I find a new partner, or maybe if I make more money, or maybe if I move to a new town, or maybe if I lose 10 pounds or something and be able to go on vacation, you know, that's going to bring me happiness. And so the soul is saying, no, this dissatisfaction in life is not about not having things. It's not knowing who you are.
Yeah, so the question from I've had this conversation with some of my scientist friends, and
You have scientist friends?
Yeah, and their question is essentially this. Are there any examples of this merging of both the magical aspects of human beings with a scientific perspective? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. If we simply go back to Mesoamerica, which is central Mexico now, and southern Mexico and some of the Central American countries, the people just 500 years ago, they had that shamanistic perspective. Their priests were basically shamans, but they were also scientists.
Mm. Even in Egypt too, right? They was for both.
They had astronomy. They had mathematics down to a high science, architecture, literature, oration, poetry. In other words, they were high culture. They knew what they were doing scientifically, mathematically, but they also understood that connection to nature and the bigger cosmos in a very intricate way, in a very sophisticated way, and they understood its importance.
Wouldn't you say also that people like Leonardo da Vinci and I'm trying to think of his name. Gravity. What's his name? Why can't I think of his name?
Newton.
They were alchemists. And so mm-hmm. they were very, like, we, you know, in the West, they'll all say, oh, wait, they're looking at, you know, he's came up with all the, like, the airplane and all these, like, drawings, but he was using alchemy as well. And Newton, too. Newton's known for, you know, this kind of idea of gravity and the theory of gravity, but he had all this other mystical stuff that no one talks about. So it's been there, but it's almost like the science has taken over and has a predominance because yes. you can measure it with your senses versus with the mystical, you can't measure it.
And I would say it's a pseudoscience because the real scientific method would always acknowledge, okay, there are things that are unknown, and those are just as valid to hold in mind as the things we do know. Mm. Whereas a lot of the science today, it's primarily to prop up their perspective, meaning that we think it's this way, and therefore all our experimentation and theory is going to go towards propping this idea up. Mm. That's not real science. Real science is we're open to what we don't know.
Yeah.
And we're not defining it. We're not neglecting it. We're not saying it's not important. Mm-hmm. We're simply saying we don't know that area of our particular topic. But so there is this history of human beings being able to balance the traditional shamanistic perspective of cosmology with a very scientific perspective.
And those cultures lasted thousands of years, where we're just kind of a couple hundred years in modern history.
Yes.
And we're ready, almost blowing up the planet and destroying the nature. You know, it's like, why don't we go back to these, you know, actually another culture that was, they had science too, but in a different way, the Aborigines, they've been around for 40,000 years and they were very mystical, very shamanistic, but they also had kind of like a way to calculate things. And so us disconnecting from the earth and the natural, not only the earth, but our deeper self or soul, is really the crisis that we're facing in world right now. Like we can't like solve it just through technology. We have to go inward and
yeah.
become conscious of these parts of ourselves.
That's right. From the Jungian perspective, we would say that the key is going to come from the collective unconscious, from the symbols that arise from the collective unconscious, because that's where the real solution comes from, in that it changes the perception of human beings. And it is about then if you think about what's going on individually when they go through a transformation, that transformation has to happen now on a global scale. People have to have mass shifts in perception.
So mass hypnosis, maybe? Just kidding. That's what we're experiencing now, is the mass misinformation and media and all that kind of clouding over what's real.
Well,
I would turn on the TV and see people talk about their spiritual life or their collective unconscious. You know, it's like.
But I don't see technology as the problem. Say technology is the expression of the mind.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's the idea of technology, or the idea of how
to use it.
How to use technology? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because we're using technology right now, and it's.
Yeah, technology is neutral.
Yeah.
It's essentially what you do with it. It's a tool. So. It's simply that the idea doesn't exist yet of that balance between how we use technology and how we interact and our relationship with the natural world.
And I see this in personal development too. There's that balance. Like everyone wants to know about the neuroscience, and everything's neuroscience. Neuroscience changed the brain. And then we're forgetting about the spiritual. And then there's people that are just spiritual, spiritual, spiritual. Forget about the science. It doesn't exist. It's an illusion. And we need that. We need both. We need the intellectual, what we know about science, what we know about the brain, what we know about perception, and also informing us of what we know about our deeper knowledge of the psyche.
Yeah.
So this was a great topic. I've really read a lot about shamanism. I've heard of it. I mean, being in Colorado, everyone says they're shaman, and they use that term a lot. A lot of people to kind of name what they do. And now I see how this is really very relevant for people that are doing healing or helping work. And so comments. Thank you for my top. I haven't worn this in a while. I love this color. How do you use shamanism in coaching? And so I think if you take the seven things we talked about today, that would be how to use it. But I would say Jungian coaching is probably one of the best ways.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we definitely take our cue from Jung in that say that we're insisting on understanding this tradition mm-hmm. from a psychological perspective and a spiritual perspective, right? Of what is going on individually in us, as well as respecting the traditions mm-hmm. of other cultures. Mm-hmm. But not just trying to emulate other cultures, but giving them their space, their respect, but asking, as Jung insisted, right, that we look for those elements in our own experience, mm-hmm. meaning that we find our connection to nature, our connection to the divine, to magic, in our own circumstances.
And it's right here in every moment.
That's right. Through our own internal shadow work, essentially. Yeah. That's the beginning of it.
And for me, it's like when you said that, like there's magic all around us. We don't even realize the fact that we're alive and that we're aware that we're alive and that we're on this rock hurling through space in the middle of the cosmos is such a mystical experience. And we go to every night and we dream and we go to these other places. I mean, we have it right here. We don't need to always go to this other place or do these rituals that aren't aligned with our culture that we grew up in. It's fun to do those things, but we don't need to in order to have a mystical life. We don't have to force ourselves into a persona of someone that's not in our heart connected to who we are. But we may find that, you know, there's certain, like I'm German and I have those German roots. So I find that, you know, Jung had spoken German and it's like, oh, it's weird that I would kind of pull my culture and my ancestry toward those things. So. Another question, I've always been drawn to shamanism and lately trying to connect with my ancestral roots in indigenous Celtic shamanism.
Oh, yeah, great traditions there.
So she's talking about ceremony rites as a way to access deeper parts of the consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And ritual and rites of passage are very powerful, an anchor in insights and revelation.
Absolutely.
Any questions? Other questions? No? Okay. Well, I really am. It's so interesting because, you know, I was surprised at how relevant this was to everyone. Is if you're, especially if you're a coach or you're someone in the helping profession, helping others. I mean, even the doctors, medical doctors, are modern day shamans in a way. They're looking to help a person in heal through the alchemy of the medicine. So this is like a mystical aspect that goes on as well. When I did medical hypnotherapy early in my career, they did research actually, and they said that the EMT worker, the fireman that would show up on a scene, if he believed or she believed that person was going to make it, it would actually dictate if that person made it or not, because there's kind of a transmission that happens. So they're showing up at the scene, and if they tell the person, you're going to make it, and they really believed it, that person would make it. But if they showed up and they kind of expected, like, I don't know if this person's going to pull through, it was like always that the belief of the person. So, you know, it really is that kind of, whether you're helping someone save their life or change their life, you have to believe in what you're doing. You have to believe that that person has the potential, and that's the job of the shaman, is to see the bigger picture and bring it in.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us.
Yes.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care, everyone.
Stay well.
Bye. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Soul Sessions with Creative Mind. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any episode. And also join us on Facebook in our live interactive community, Jung In Life Coaching with Creative Mind University. Have a great and wonderful day, and we'll see you next week.